From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo continues to defend President Trump's decision to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Today, Pompeo told reporters that there is no truth to Iran's claim that Soleimani was in Baghdad on a diplomatic mission when the U.S. launched its attack on Friday.
Was indeed Iranian propaganda. It's not new. We've heard these same lies before. It's fundamentally false. He was not there on a diplomatic mission.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us now from Washington. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the administration is under pressure to provide evidence that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against the United States. Did Pompeo offer any evidence?
He did not, other than to describe, as we just heard there, that the United States disputes this characterization by Iraqis and Iranians and others, that Soleimani was visiting Baghdad as a part of some master sweep through the Middle East to try to de-escalate tensions or negotiate peace agreements. Pompeo says that was not the case, but we still don't know exactly what he might have been up to or what plans he might have been cooking up or whether, in fact, there were attacks against American interests or other targets that might have been a part of his travels in the region.
But the administration has been making the case that they did this attack preemptively to stop Americans from being killed by Soleimani. There's a group of bipartisan lawmakers known as the Gang of Eight that will get a briefing later today on the killing. What do they want to know?
That's right. These are the leaders of the chambers and the leaders of the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees on these on both sides of the Capitol. They'll want to ask about some of these questions. Was there an imminent threat that Soleimani was planning that his death has neutralized or disrupted? Or when the administration officials have been saying that, are they talking in more general terms, as in Soleimani has been responsible for attacks and American deaths in the past, and this action was taken to stop him from bringing those about in the future, but he didn't have anything that was ready to drop, so to speak. We don't know the answer to that question. The other question they're going to ask is what comes next here, whether, for example, the administration has intelligence that makes it believe Soleimani's death would prompt the Iranian supreme leader and Iran's president and others to recalculate their position vis-a-vis the United States and Middle East, or whether the United States is going to be poised to respond to what the Iranian government has said, including to our colleague Mary Louise Kelly, who's in Iran, will be revenge and a campaign of Iran's choosing at the time of Iran's choosing that will try and pay the United States back for Soleimani's death.
I want to switch gears to impeachment because that's the other big thing happening today in Washington, or potentially we might learn some more about it. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, is being contemptuous of the American people for holding on to the articles of impeachment.
What the country got was the most rushed, least thorough, and most unfair presidential impeachment in American history. And now the prosecution seems to have gotten cold feet.
The House is back in session this afternoon. Is anyone expecting Pelosi to move the articles over to the Senate today?
Probably not. She and other Democrats have pointed to events, including news reports and an important statement by the former National Security Advisor John Bolton, as reason why they were smart to keep these articles of impeachment from the Senate to be sure that the conditions under which a Senate impeachment trial for Trump begins are, they say, as fair as they can. McConnell's position is that the purpose of a Senate trial is not to find things out or develop information or hear from witnesses. It's to assess the evidence that the House has already gathered, which is why there's this dispute that you have been hearing about between him and Republicans there and Pelosi and the Democrats in the House.
Well, and here is the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer responding to that this morning.
Republicans were dodging and twisting themselves into pretzels, trying to explain why someone with direct knowledge of what the president did shouldn't testify under oath immediately. I believe that illustrates the fundamental weakness of the Republican position.
Now, Schumer is sort of hoping that there are enough moderate Republican senators who will come out and say they want to hear from witnesses. Is it likely at this point that that will happen and that somebody like a John Bolton would actually eventually testify?
That's a great question. It's kind of an awkward political situation for all concerned because the other thing that you heard from Schumer there was something very like the position taken by Republicans in the House. He's complaining about the process. He says it's unfair. He says he's not being treated the right way. Republicans are in the minority in the House, and that's why they leveled these complaints. Democrats are the minority in the Senate, and that's why you hear Schumer leveling those complaints. It is feasible that if enough Republican senators were to agree to vote vote this way, they could change the rules of the game and have there be witnesses or evidence. But no one knows whether that will happen or whether McConnell has brought enough of his own members around so that if this question does get to that point, he will be able to move ahead in the way he wants with no witnesses and no new evidence, simply a trial for Trump.
That is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's bring in a member of Congress who is in a position to deal with these issues. Ro Khanna is a Democrat from Silicon Valley, an advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
You've said that the killing of General Soleimani is unconstitutional and that any further action against Iran could be an impeachable offense. Why is this impeachable?
If the president gets us into an endless war in the Middle East without congressional approval, especially when you have bipartisan majorities in the Congress that have said that we do not want that war, then he's violating the Article I congressional power.
Let me ask you something, though. The president hasn't sent troops to war with Iran. He's ordered a strike on a general that the U.S. blames for the deaths of hundreds of American soldiers. And we learned that President George W. Bush reportedly also considered killing Soleimani. So this is someone who was considered a known threat to the U.S. What's your response to that?
Well, Soleimani definitely has American blood on his hands, but that doesn't mean that the president can go in and kill him and engage in an assassination without consulting Congress. Their argument is that it was an imminent threat. But all the legal scholars who have looked at this have said that this is not an imminent threat.
Do you have any other information on what the threat was beyond what the public knows?
I do not. And the important point here is it's the president's burden of proof to show that there was an imminent threat. The president chose not to get congressional authorization. And when Mike Pompeo was pressed on this issue, he was unable to even offer a location. He was unable to offer any specifics on a timeline. And he was unable to explain why the killing of Soleimani would prevent the attack.
You know, though, we have been hearing, though, that Iran had been taking increasingly bold actions in the region. We know that Iran shot down a U.S. drone last year. The country is blamed for that embassy attack in December and lots of other attacks in the region. The argument here is that Iran needs to see a strong response to deter them from carrying out further attacks. I know that you said you believe that killing Soleimani does not really take out that threat. But what do you say to that, that he was a powerful leader and it does send a strong message?
Well, the message it's going to send is to increase the cycle of violence. Here is a rational response to what we should be doing with Iran. We need to end the maximum pressure campaign that has fueled some of this violence. We need to reinitiate negotiation and diplomacy with Iran and have an immediate ceasefire on violence. We need to get back into the JCPOA, which we withdrew from. We need to start pulling our troops out responsibly from Iraq and Syria. So this is a comprehensive strategy that can work. The reason we know this is it was working when President Obama was trying it. We did not have these incidents against Americans. This is a problem that President Trump has created.
You and Senator Bernie Sanders introduced legislation that would prohibit funding for offensive military force against Iran. Your bill is unlikely to pass the Senate, and there's a lot of legal debate about how much power Congress has to constrain the president in cases of national security. Why take this action?
We took this action for the National Defense Authorization and our amendment, which would have defunded any offensive action against Iran or Soleimani, passed the House. It had the majority of support in the Senate, and it was stripped from the National Defense Authorization bill, which authorizes military funding. I believe if that hadn't been stripped, we could have prevented, frankly, the Soleimani killing. It's important for Congress now to reassert our power. Our framers gave Congress the power of the purse. Ultimately, all of the funding for the military originates in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives needs to make it clear that we will not fund offensive action against Iran or Iranian officials without authorization. And even though Senator Sanders and my bill may not pass both the House and the Senate, it lays a marker to make it clear that we're simply not going to fund these kind of involvement in hostilities in Iran.
My last question for you, Iran has vowed revenge. you know, everyone's asking, what are we expecting Iran to do? And my question to you is, how should the U.S. respond to retaliatory actions from Iran?
This is why we need to reopen diplomacy. We need to have a ceasefire to end the cycle of violence. We need to make it clear that any Iranian revenge would only worsen the cycle of violence. It would force the United States' hand to respond. And the rational course of action is to have a ceasefire and to have diplomacy. The problem here is that the president isn't engaged in that kind of diplomacy. I almost hope that the speaker or other officials, senior ranking officials, may be able to engage in backdoor diplomacy with Iran to try to ratchet down the tension.
That's Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat of California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
NPR's Life Kit wants to help you make changes that actually stick this new year. From how to do dry January to how to start a creative habit, we've got new episodes all month to help you start the year off right. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
The sixth and final season of the Canadian TV show Schitt's Creek, that's S-C-H-I-T-T-S, begins tonight on Pop TV. It's about a wealthy family that suddenly loses everything and is forced to move to a dumpy hotel in a small rural town that they bought as a joke years ago, a town called Schitt's Creek. It stars Catherine O'Hara and Annie Murphy, as well as Eugene Levy and his son Daniel Levy, who are the show's co-creators and co-executive producers. I spoke with them last year at the start of the fifth season, and started by asking them where the idea came from, because it is very different than any show I've ever seen.
Thank you very much.
In a great way. I mean, I've watched every episode of it so far.
I brought sort of the first germ of an idea to my dad very early on. The premise of playing on this sort of cultural awareness we now have of how wealthy people live. I think through reality television, we've been able to get an incredibly dimensional whether we want it or not, idea of how wealthy people live their lives. And I thought it could be an interesting premise to examine as a comedy what would happen if all the money was taken away and these people were forced to confront what really matters in their lives. And I brought the idea to my dad thinking, you know, his comedic sensibility is something that is very specific and grounded in something real, and I thought it could really lend itself to this concept, which I think has the potential or had the potential to go quite broad and cartoony. It needed the opposite. It needed something, an infusion of real, genuine comedy.
And when you say cartoonish, one of the things about this show, and I know that you've both talked about this before, is that because we get to know the characters and we see them in serious situations as well as funny moments, the comedy works even better.
Well, that's the it's a tack that we took that right off the top, and that was kind of a comedic tone that we had in the movies that Chris Guest and I did together,
Best in Show and others.
Yeah, which is a grounding of character where you never step outside of your character's boundaries to get a laugh.
And we always approached the show from day one as if it were a drama, and it is. I mean, inherently, it's quite tragic what happens to this family, and the comedy really comes from the characters interacting with each other and interacting with their circumstance. So I think because it's rooted in something real and we're not necessarily playing huge gags, you're able to tightrope walk that fine balance between comedy and also exploring slightly more emotional moments and revelations as well.
Another thing that I was thinking about is that fashion actually plays a pretty big role in the show. Every single character has something that they wear that's pretty unique.
Yeah.
Including you.
Certainly. You know, I think it was really important for me that fashion played a part, a big part in the show. I think because it was an area where we could explore character and not have to write it. And what clothes do in our show is act as a sort of perpetual reminder of where these people came from without having to continually say, remember that time when?
Mm-hmm. Now you can see where these people came from just by looking at them.
a wig store, for one, because your wife on the show, played by Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
By the way, you two have been husband and wife more than once now on screen.
We've done a few things together over the years, Catherine and I. Yeah, we were husband and wife in Best in Show. We were husband and wife in A Mighty Wind.
Right.
We were husband and wife in Over the Hedge.
What do you think it is about the chemistry that the two of you have that works so well time after time with different characters?
I think it's because we have the same style of working. You know, we both come out of improvisational background, mm-hmm. but we're basically actors at heart, not comedians. And we like to get our laughs through character, so everything's got to be set to the point where we know exactly what the character is going to be doing.
How much improv is there in what you're doing with Schitt's Creek?
I would say not very much. I mean, I would say it's 90 to 95% scripted. And
I think it's that extra 5, 10% that really adds that – it's like that special sauce to the show, giving people the freedom to experiment or ad-lib a little bit. Really sort of customizes each character. And I think from an acting standpoint, it allows you a little bit of freedom to like nestle into who you're playing and feel free to explore that a little bit. There's really no ego involved.
Can you think of an example of that happening? Something that you remember that was not scripted?
Well, I don't know. Usually at the end of scenes, when a scene is about to end and a character wants to kind of go on, knowing that they've got the ending to the scene, but what the hell?
I know that there's a scene in the first season between Annie and I where we're fighting over who sleeps in the bed closest to the door, because the idea is if a murderer were to come into the motel, whoever's sleeping closest to the door would get murdered first. And Annie came up with this line, which was, "You get murdered first for once." And then it became this sort of back and forth, and we really ran with it. There's just some things like, you know, when Catherine O'Hara does a, you know, first walked in and did her accent as Moira.
You try enjoying a puff pastry with everyone around you scratching.
I could write very funny things for her, but nothing would be as funny as her delivering those lines in that accent. I mean, she just has the
ability. She came up with that herself?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Catherine's quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And on a show like this, you know, when you hire Catherine, you're getting more than just somebody who can deliver lines mm-hmm. funny. She brings everything to what she does. She adds so much to the character. She has her own ideas. The wigs, for example, mm-hmm. were her idea. So Moira would wear a different wig depending on, you know, her emotional
right.
mindset of that particular day. She adds so much.
I want to ask you, and let's listen to a clip from the show. This is a scene with a conversation between David, played by you, Daniel, and your boyfriend on the show and business partner, Patrick.
David, I've spent most of my life not knowing what right was supposed to feel like, and then I met you, and everything changed. You make me feel right, David.
That is quite possibly one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say. Outside of the Downton Christmas special.
It's the truth.
I know. It's just that my truth is that I am damaged goods, and this has really messed things up for me.
So one of the things about this show that I've never seen anywhere else is that you have a gay relationship that is never talked about by anybody in the town. The parents don't react. It's mm-hmm. not – it's just completely normal.
Yes, as it should be.
Right.
I tried to write my experience. I tried to write an experience that I know that friends of mine have had. I think that's the big thing that seems to be connecting with people, is the fact that there is an ease to the relationship and that we write the relationship in a casual way. And that was very deliberate. I think because, you know, we're so accustomed to seeing queer love stories that are put in jeopardy by outside forces. I mean, you know, it's the sort of Brokeback Mountain effect of anytime you see two queer people in love, there has to be some kind of consequence. So to propose a world where there is no consequence and two people can love each other sort of wholly
in small town America.
In small town America, and ultimately show that what comes from that is freedom and love and joy. It's a form, I guess, of sort of quiet protest, saying that this is how things should be. And, you know, the choice to leave homophobia out of the equation on our show was deliberate because I'm a firm believer that we learn through what we see. And when we feel like we are being taught a lesson, we have our guards up because we don't want to be schooled on something. But to present something as it should be, I think, has a much more powerful effect in people's homes. And the letters that we've received from families who have watched the show together and it's changed their own relationships, it's I guess it's a testament to the fact that it does seem to be working, even if it's just one family at a time.
Yeah, a love story is just a love story. And that's the tone that's set on the show. And as Dan just said, the effects are quite amazing when it comes to how it's affecting people out there.
And that was your experience?
Yeah. It was never questioned for me. I mean, sure, there was bullying in high school. But for me, my experience has been relatively easy compared to what is happening in many parts of this country and others. So meeting people in a respectful way and not pinning people against a wall with an agenda, but rather just sort of saying, this is what we're doing. It's seemingly helping people, which is an incredibly rewarding part of the job.
Yeah, it just normalizes everything.
By the way, I said small town America. Where is Schitt's Creek? Have you actually said where it is physically? Do
nope.
we know?
Nope.
We haven't.
It's like Springfield in The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Yeah. No?
We have not. Schitt's Creek is Schitt's Creek.
Eugene and Daniel Levy, the co-stars and co-creators of Schitt's Creek, speaking with me last year. The show returns with its final season tonight.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
In Arizona, Native American women are dying of pregnancy-related causes at a rate 4 times higher than those of white women. And most of those deaths could have been prevented, according to the state and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, there's a Navajo midwife doing something about it. KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
When Brianna Groton arrived at the hospital on the Navajo Nation in northeast Arizona to deliver her first child, the doctor told her the baby was at risk and they needed to induce labor.
It just was like intervention after intervention, you know, and I ended up getting an epidural and then my son ended up getting sick and I didn't get to take him home until he was 6 weeks old.
After bringing her baby home, she read up on hospital interventions, the risks, and how to avoid them. So her second birth was completely different.
It was important for me to have my sister there because you're in such a vulnerable place. When I felt like I wasn't getting my point across, I knew that my sister would speak up for me.
Groton has made it her mission now as a labor and delivery nurse at an Indian Health Service hospital to help other women.
Navajo women in general are just not very assertive. And so it's, the doctor told me this is best, so I'm just going to go along with it. My biggest thing is informed choice.
When nurse midwife Nicole Gonzalez discovered there weren't enough pregnancy support professionals, or doulas, on the Navajo Nation, she started a Native Women's Health Collective called the Changing Women Initiative. and she organized this doula training, where 40 women sit on blankets in a traditional dirt floor dwelling called a hogan.
By having a program where doulas help women understand they're going through this very spiritual process and having these conversations about the tests and the labs and the ultrasounds, they're more likely to have a better outcome than having somebody who feels invisible.
Gonzalez says the maternal mortality numbers are a result of many things that failed. Increased closures of maternity units across the country, including two on the Navajo Nation. Transportation and distance on a reservation the size of West Virginia.
Just 30 miles from the nearest hospital increases a woman's risk for maternal death, you know, a small for size baby, preterm delivery.
Gonzalez says a pregnant woman should have at least 10 prenatal visits with a healthcare provider. Most Native women are lucky to get to half. Those seemingly small issues can lead to major complications, like hemorrhaging and cardiomyopathy. CDC study lead author Dave Goodman says 60% of the deaths reported could have been prevented.
What was striking was that such a large proportion of these deaths were determined to be preventable. It's hard to accept that in the United States, women are dying from preventable causes.
The CDC is working with the National Indian Health Board to organize a Native-led maternal mortality review board to help get at why women are dying. The American Medical Association is also getting involved. President Patrice Harris addressed a U.S. House committee on the subject last May.
We are just beginning to have the conversations around implicit biases and how they affect care.
Harris says the AMA is working with medical schools to integrate training that addresses biases and cultural humility. After 2 days of doula training, the Navajo women take a break to play a game. Gonzalez says she wishes the world could see them this way, a community lifting each other up. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales.
Two inmates who escaped a Mississippi prison last week have been apprehended. The two fled the state penitentiary in Parchman, the same prison where three prisoners were found dead last week. Two others died at different state facilities during the outbreak of gang violence that started in December. Authorities say the recent chaos is a symptom of systemic problems plaguing Mississippi's prison system. Joining us now with the latest is Elisa Zhu, investigative reporter for Mississippi's Clarion Ledger newspaper. Elisa, welcome. And what more can you tell us about how these inmates died?
All of the Mississippi Department of Corrections has really been saying about the violence that has been breaking out all over the state since December 29th is that these have been major disturbances. But it does seem like these are fights. All the inmates that have died of multiple stab wounds. Inmates must have shanks or knives or other things they are stabbing each other with. I've been getting lots of messages and calls from worried family members all over the state. It can be quite difficult to get verified information out of the prison system.
You mentioned talking with family and friends. What do we know about the victims?
When I spoke to the ex-wife of one of the victims, she wanted everyone to understand that these are not just convicts, which, you know, they all have been convicted of a crime, some of them very serious crimes. But they're more than that. They are fathers, they are brothers, they are sons and cousins. And they range, you know, from, I think, 25 to 40. They are from Parchman Prison, like you mentioned, as well as the South Mississippi Correctional Institution and the Chickasaw County Regional Correctional Facility.
You know, it might help our listeners to put this into context. Mississippi has the highest incarceration rate in the country, and this isn't the first time we've seen high numbers of deaths. Federal figures show that an average of 51 inmates died in prisons there per year between 2001 and 2014. NBC News also reports 16 deaths in a single month in 2018. What do these numbers reflect?
You can kind of think of what's happening in Mississippi's right now as a fire. The kindling would be these long-running systemic issues that we've seen with the criminal justice and prison systems. We talk often about the underfunding, the understaffing, and then also all the issues that come with those problems. So if you think about it, if you don't have enough staff to run a prison, then the prison can go on lockdown for long periods of time. The prison where the first death occurred recently, it had been on lockdown all year. There was no visitation. Inmates could have limited movement within the prison itself, so limited exercise time. The food quality is poor. We've heard complaints about food not arriving on time. And so all of these issues are the kindling, while the gang violence that the Mississippi governor and Department of Corrections have been talking about would be the spark. But without plenty of dry kindling, there wouldn't be a fire. You wouldn't be seeing this level of widespread violence.
How is the governor actually responding and local officials?
Over the weekend, we saw the governor tweeting, mostly centering the blame on the gangs. He said that gang violence will not be tolerated. And then he also said in another tweet that Mississippi must invest in its prison system. As far as the Mississippi Department of Corrections goes, it's been pretty hard to get information out of them about what's going on. They said they're not releasing a ton of information because of concerns about safety and the ongoing investigation. But some of the questions I've asked I feel like are pretty basic, such as we don't even know how many inmates have been injured. We also don't know where violence has broken out in the past week or so, besides the three locations where there were deaths. And those are questions I've asked repeatedly and they have not answered. Today is actually the first day of the legislative session, so it'll be really interesting to watch to see if the ongoing violence in the prison system will make a change to the legislative priorities. I know there is a protest scheduled, which I will be covering later this day.
That's Alisa Zhu, investigative reporter for the Mississippi's Clarion Ledger. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Facebook users won't be able to post altered videos known as deepfakes anymore after a policy change the company announced last night. Facebook is under pressure to crack down on disinformation ahead of the 2020 election, but there's already talk that these new rules don't go far enough. For more, we're joined now by Drew Harwell, who covers artificial intelligence for The Washington Post. And Drew, welcome to the show. And first of all, you and your colleagues broke this story before Facebook confirmed it last night. The company is banning deepfakes, as we said, but not all doctored videos. Can you explain that?
That's right. They're drawing a line between these highly manipulated, computer-generated deepfake videos of somebody appearing to say something they never really said, and sort of lightly altered videos where maybe the words are skewed out of place or the speed is slowed down, such like of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi last year, where it was edited to make her sound drunk. Those videos will be okay, but these highly doctored videos will be banned from the platform.
Why are those types of videos okay, as the company explained?
Yeah, in their mind, they feel like one is specifically meant to deceive and the other could potentially be a simple satire or a parody or just sort of video editing in its natural state. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are saying this is just going for the low-hanging fruit of these deepfake videos. It's not really attacking the core issue, which is how Facebook can be used to spread misinformation.
A spokesman for Pelosi tweeted, "Facebook wants you to think the problem is video editing technology, but the real problem is Facebook's refusal to stop the spread of disinformation." What about that? Are deepfakes really the big area of concern? Do we have any estimate of how many there are or have actually been reported on the platform?
We don't really. And deepfakes have been the technical boogeyman for disinformation lately because they are so, technically sophisticated. But there's so few of them online that have really driven the conversation. I mean, the biggest problem with deepfakes is that they can be used to harass and humiliate women by superimposing their faces into pornography. The real issues around political misinformation are really simple things like, photoshopped images and bad captions, pulling images from one place person saying it describes another. Those are the real issues, but they're also harder to find and they're harder to draw a clear line around. So, you know, that's the frustration with some people. Is Facebook putting a Band-Aid on this sort of deepfake issue that's not really a problem just yet while sort of ignoring, you know, the huge wound that is disinformation more generally around the web?
Remind us of the pressure Facebook is facing when it comes to deepfakes specifically, why they may be coming to this decision now.
I mean, it's 2020, and Facebook doesn't want a repeat of 2016, right, where it was weaponized as this place where anything could go viral, no matter whether it was true or not. And, you know, Facebook has always said they don't want to be the arbiter of truth, right? And that's their phrase. They don't want to be the judge for reality online. And yet they have this extremely powerful, influential platform for communicating information around the world. And so, you know, they're kind of trying to have it both ways. So I think they're feeling the pressure of wanting to be a place where people get healthy information, but they're also sort of feeling the stress of having to police reality online.
With a little bit of time I have with you, tomorrow a congressional committee in the House of Representatives will be hearing a hearing on manipulation and deception in the digital age. Facebook is expected to send someone. What are you watching for?
I think we're going to be watching what is Facebook saying about its commitment to these kinds of issues and how much is this a real rule designed around tackling real problems and how much of this is just sort of public relations spin. But I'm also sort of curious what the other lawmakers are saying. What are they worried about in terms of misinformation? You know, it's not just a Russian sort of hacker cyber attack thing. The domestic misinformation can come from within the country, right? And it can be spread by people who may have sort of good intent. So, you know, this is internet in 2020. This is the potential for danger here. And I'm going to be curious what Facebook can do to solve that problem.
Yeah, also really addressing this idea, do people actually know the difference between heavily edited videos and deep fake videos and if this ruling will have any effect on people's understanding of that? That's Drew Harwell, technology reporter for The Washington Post. Drew, thank you.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today that the U.S. military will follow the rules of international law if there are further military strikes on Iran, which presumably means the U.S. government will not destroy culturally sensitive sites inside the country, something President Trump threatened to do if Iran attacked Americans. The sites we're talking about are very old and very important to human history. To learn more, we're joined by Kishwar Rizvi, professor of Islamic art and architecture at Yale University. Welcome.
Thank you.
So there are more than 20 UNESCO World Heritage sites in Iran. One is Persepolis. Tell us about Persepolis, first of all, and why it's so important.
I think it's important to note, as you do, that there are more than 20 UNESCO World Heritage sites, and they include archaeological sites like Persepolis, but also natural spaces such as deserts and forests. Persepolis is important because, of course, it represents the earliest civilizations like Mesopotamia, from which it derives. It was founded in about 518, 515 by Darius the Great, one of the rulers of the Achaemenid Empire, an important Persian empire that fought against the Byzantines and established itself as one of the greatest powers of the ancient world later on.
And it was at one time partially destroyed by Alexander the Great.
Exactly, it was. Herodotus writes about Cyrus and these great ancient empires. I mean, it's part of world history. And hence, you know, since 1979 was established as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO.
Let's talk about some of the other sites. The city of Isfahan is considered Iran's national treasure.
Absolutely. This is a medieval city. It was part of the old Silk Roads towards both the maritime routes as well as the territorial routes that went from Asia to Europe. But Isfahan, of course, becomes an important treasure for the Iranian national mythos because it was established in the late 16th century as the capital of the Safavid Empire. Early modern travelers would come and discuss its massive plaza, which was compared to San Marco in Venice. Hmm. It has great monuments surrounding this plaza, such as the Friday Mosque, the Great Imperial Palace, the Ali Rapu. It really is the epitome of Persian architecture and urbanism.
Many of the other cultural sites are Shia shrines, including the Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad, Iran, the largest mosque in the world.
That's right. It's an extremely important site. I think it's important to note, as you know, Iran is a Shia nation, has been again since the 16th century, mm-hmm. and has two of the most important Shia shrines, that of Imam Reza in Mashhad in northeastern Iran, as well as in Qom, that of his sister Fatima Masuma, which is close to Tehran. The other Shia shrines are in Iraq, in Karbala, in Najaf, in Baghdad, in Samarra, which really also points to the very intertwined histories, cultures, and religious identities of Iraq and Iran. These two shrines in Iran are revered not only by Iranians, but Shia Muslims across the world.
With all of the war and unrest in the birthplace of civilization over the last many decades. Yeah. How much of these cultural sites have been destroyed?
I don't have the exact numbers of how much has been destroyed. They certainly have been targeted. The Shia shrines in Iraq have been targeted for the past, 10, 15 years, both by Daesh, by other Sunni forces. And the troubling part is that these are lived spaces. The shrines in particular are highly populated. They are pilgrimage sites where millions of people visit every year. So we're also talking about targets that would cause great damage, human loss and sacrifice as well. So one has to be very careful talking about these buildings and archaeological sites as though they were, museum pieces, which they indeed are, but also they're very intertwined with the lives of millions of people.
So what did you think when you heard President Trump initially threaten on Twitter that he would target these sites and was willing to attack them in retaliation for whatever Iran does?
Well, my first thought was that we're no better in some sense than those we have condemned. The Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed by the Taliban in the early 2000s. More recently, Daesh blew up the Great Mosque in Mosul. When we do something similar, how can we have the moral high ground and say that, we are only going to follow the rules of war and target military and defensive targets? So really, I see this kind of an act as provocative, but also unfortunate.
As you've described some of these cultural sites to us, it's clear that you not only have studied them, but you've visited them.
Yes, I do. And in fact, I was hoping to be in Iran this winter, but it's not safe any longer for U.S. citizens to travel there, which is really a loss for many of us.
That is Kishwar Rizvi, who's a professor of Islamic art and architecture at Yale University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.